I'm Bianca Stone. Welcome back to the Odin Psyche podcast. Please look at the poem, The Seventh Elegy, by Rainer Maria Rilke, translated by Stephen Mitchell. A free PDF download can be found at podcast.ruthstonehouse.org. You can follow it by the social media links that I have on my Instagram, Odin Psyche, or on Twitter X, Odin Psyche. It will be in the Seventh Elegy podcast show notes page. Scroll down. Please enjoy my rambling interpretation of Die Sieben Elegie. Far above, we hear on the earth, so sonic, so grounded in this poem are we. But then we have I love this image of the bird and that the poet's cry could be like the bird. That's what the wooing should be like, this cry that just is in the world between earth and sky. Of course, a parallel to the angel as well. And we do this through poetry. Beautifully idealistic vision of poetry. It's not about sexual pleasure, but it's the rich pleasure of observation of the nature of things. What I see poets like Rilke doing and Lucretius, poets who really are looking and paying attention not only to the external world very closely, but the internal world. Are we paying attention to the nature of the internal things? We end up doing that second part that Novalis talked about, which is like leaving the house, paying attention to the external world.
Die Sieben Elegie. Not wooing. No longer shall wooing, voice that has outgrown it, be the nature of your cry. But instead, you would cry out as purely as a bird when the quickly ascending season lifts him up, nearly forgetting that he is a suffering creature and not just a single heart being flung into brightness, into the intimate skies. Just like him, you would be wooing, not any less purely, so that still unseen, she would sense you, the silent lover, in whom a reply slowly awakens and, as she hears you, grows warm, the ardent companion to your own most daring emotion. Oh, and springtime would hold it. Everywhere it would echo the song of annunciation, first the small questioning notes intensified all around by the sheltering silence of a pure affirmative day. Then up the stairway of calls to the dreamed of temple of the future, and then the trill, like a fountain, which in its rising jet already anticipates its fall in a game of promises, and still ahead, summer. Not only all the dawns of summer, not only how they change themselves into day and shine with beginning, not only the days so tender around flowers and above, around the patterned treetops, so strong, so intense, not only the reverence of all these unfolded powers, not only the pathways, not only the meadows at sunset, not only after a late storm, the deep breathing freshness, not only approaching sleep and a premonition, childhood. How often you outdistanced the man you loved, breathing, breathing, after the blissful chase and passed on into freedom. Truly being here is glorious. Even you knew it. You girls who seemed to be lost, to go under, in the filthiest streets of the city, festering there, or wide open for garbage. For each of you had an hour, or perhaps not even an hour, a barely measurable time between two moments, when you were granted a sense of being everything. Your veins flowed with being. But we can so easily forget what our laughing neighbor neither confirms nor envies. We want to display it, to make it visible, though even the most visible happiness can't reveal itself to us until we transform it within. Nowhere, beloved, will world be but within us. Our life passes in transformation, and the external shrinks into less and less. Where once an enduring house was, now a cerebral structure crosses our path, completely belonging to the realm of concepts, as though it still stood in the brain. Our age has built itself vast reservoirs of power, formless as the straining energy that it wrests from the earth. Temples are no longer known. It is we who secretly save up these extravagances of the heart. Where one of them still survives, a thing that was formerly prayed to, worshipped, knelt before, just as it is, it passes into the invisible world. Many no longer perceive it, yet miss the chance to build it inside themselves now, with pillars and statues, greater. Each torpid turn of the world has such disinherited ones, to whom neither the past belongs, nor yet what has nearly arrived. For even the nearest moment is far from mankind, though we should not be confused by this, but strengthened in our task of preserving the still recognizable form. This once stood among mankind, in the midst of fate, the annihilator, in the midst of not knowing whither. It stood as if enduring and bent stars down to it from their safeguarded heavens. Angel, to you I will show it. There, in your endless vision, it shall stand, now finally upright, rescued at last. Pillars, pylons, the sphinx, the striving thrust of the cathedral, gray from a fading or alien city. Wasn't all this a miracle? Be astonished, angel, for we are this, O great one. Proclaim that we should achieve this. My breath is too short for such praise. So, after all, we have not failed to make use of these generous spaces. These spaces are ours. How frighteningly great they must be, since thousands of years have not made them overflow with our feelings. But a tower was great, wasn't it? Oh, angel, it was. Even when placed beside you, Chartreuse was great, and music reached still higher and passed far beyond us. But even a woman in love, oh, alone at night by her window, didn't she reach your knee? Don't think that I am wooing. Angel, and even if I were, you would not come, for my call is always filled with departure. Against such a powerful current, you cannot move. Like an outstretched arm is my call, and its hand held open and reaching up to seize remains in front of you, open, as if in defense and warning, ungraspable one far above.
I love this. I love this elegy so much. I wanted it to just be, but I can't help winging some comments right now. I love the power of the human voice in this poem. It's this call, right? It's not wooing. No, we're not going to woo in the same way we wooed before. We're not going to love in the same way that we think love is, this insistence upon coaxing the lover into our midst and then utterly possessing them as if that is a kind of authentic union with something beyond the tangible world. But as usual, no. Voice that has outgrown it, be the nature of your cry. No longer shall wooing, voice that has outgrown it, be the nature of your cry. But instead you would cry out purely as a bird. I wanted to read a little from the Romano Gardini, an interpretation of Rocca's Duino elegies. I've mentioned this before, but Romano Guardini, 1885 to 1968, was a Catholic priest, professor, and author. He taught theology and philosophy at the University of Berlin, and he was a real intellectual, and some of his disciples included Joseph Ratzinger, who later became a pope. Interesting to have the interpretations of a Catholic here. And we talk a lot about it in the Eighth Elegy, me and Matthias Slavina, which I will post pretty much right after this brief look at the Seventh Elegy. The version I read was by Stephen Mitchell. So here's a little bit from Romano Guardini. The Seventh Elegy takes up two themes, which were already touched on in the first and recur later in the ninth. One theme is that perfect love has no object. The other is that the real world of truth has to be built up from our inner experience. Obviously, I've been talking so much about the inner experience on here. It's interesting to talk about this right after the old intensive short-term dynamic therapy, because you know, there you are in the real world, talking about love, you know, negotiating the cure, and in the object relations, the perfect love has no object, and the real truth of the world has to be built up from our inner experience. So really giving voice to an authentic inner experience. And Matthias and I would talk a lot in the Eighth Elegy episode about this paradoxical turning inward that Rilke is one of Rilke's themes. I say paradoxical because he clearly emphasizes the reality of the inner world as being something you must address in order to be in the outer reality of the world. And in the Eighth Elegy, you know, it begins with all its eyes, the natural world looks out into the open, capital O. We talk a lot about the open. Only our eyes are turned backward and surround plant, animal, child, like traps. So there's a sort of differentiation, I think, in the I, E-Y-E, in this sort of egoic I, as turning backwards as it looks out and traps objects and doesn't see them as a sort of autonomous thing in and of itself, right? So he gets into a lot of sort of philosophical ideas too. I won't get too far into that, but I love that, you know, Guardini, this is how he starts it off, right? So the real world has to be built up of our inner experiences. I'll continue with the Guardini. We shall also encounter here again an idea which is familiar to us from the first two elegies, namely the gulf separating man from the angels. So there is a lot of, obviously, the angel is spoken to directly in here with quite a lot of sass. The distinctive feature of the Seventh Elegy is the contrast which it draws between the abundance of spring and summer on the one hand and the sad fate of those who are excluded from life's riches on the other. Not wooing, no longer shall wooing voice that's outgrown it be now the form of your cry. So your cry here means the cry of the poet. It is clear from the beginning of the second stanza, which expresses the same idea in the first person. The poet feels compelled to call out, to utter a cry of elemental longing. But this cry must not be wooing or a solicitation to another human being. For he feels that this heartfelt desire may, quote, no longer seek to be satisfied. His desire must advance from its early form of wooing to a state of perfection described in the first elegy. It must be directed beyond the outer person into the, quote, the open. His voice will then have outgrown wooing. It will have developed beyond its immature stage of possessiveness to a state of freedom. The poet does not renounce his earlier cry of solicitation because of any discordancy or impurity which it might contain. On the contrary, he feels that he could sing like a bird, and his cry would be the natural and pure expression of an inner need. I kind of thinking of the romantics here. Keats, I'm thinking, thou wast not born for death, immortal bird. No hungry generations tread thee down. The voice I hear this passing night was heard in ancient days by emperor and clown. Perhaps the self-same song that found a path through the sad heart of Ruth when, sick for home, she stood in tears amid the alien corn. The same that oft-times half charmed magic casements opening on the foam of perilous seas and fairy lands forlorn. Look at me, memorized this poem a couple years ago, still got it. So much emphasis put on the sound in this poem really makes such a visual image of the sound of the cry of this bird. And what an incredible way to make the perceived and the conceived wed together. But that cry made me think too of Wallace Stevens's not ideas about the thing, but the thing itself. You know, in March, a scrawny cry from outside seemed like a sound in his mind. He knew that he heard it. A bird's cry at daylight or before in the early March wind. That scrawny cry. I love that. That scrawny cry. It was a chorister whose sea preceded the choir. God, it's like one of my favorite endings of a poem. Knowledge by its choral rings still far away was like a new knowledge of reality. And there's this great Larry Levis poem called The Cry as well, quite a different kind of poem where he's really listing all the things that are sleeping. And then the speaker is a child, and on my last night as a child, that sleep was final. And then he walks into his parents' room where they're sleeping naked on the bed. And it's just such an incredible poem. They lay there on the bed. I saw every detail. And as I turned away, those bodies moved slightly in the languor of sleep. And my mother cried out once, but she did not awaken. And that cry stayed on in the air. And even as I turned away, their frail bodies, seen as if for the last time, reminded me of ravines on either side of the road when I ran and did not know why. This poem, too, has a long meditation on the image of a hawk, that the sunken and stooped chest of the father reminds him of a hawk in wet weather. And he's right, so there's this real connection between the cry, the human cry that lingers in the air, something really changing, something at work in a kind of transformation, and it is a very difficult but beautiful moment and is really linked with the cry of the bird in the air.
Right, so it really harkens back to the first line of the first elegie, who if I cried out would hear me. And that really gets developed over the course of the elegies in such a beautiful and complex way. Gardini. Rocca's bird is also a lark, one of the earliest songbirds of the year. The lark sings a night while it is ascending, and its song is thus closely associated with the open skies of spring, which hang so propitiously over the earth. The whole freshness of life is perfectly expressed in the soaring ascent and inexhaustible song of this bird. I'm going to skip a little ahead in what he writes. The sky still stretches above us, but our eyes are drawn upward as well. Our eyes drawn inwards as well as upwards. Aha, I love the in and up. Nietzsche describes a similar impression of depth within height in a passage of Zarathustra where he refers to the midday abyss of the sky above us. The ominous threatening quality of Nietzsche's abyss of light, varying in color from blue to dark green or black,
is absent from the elegy. Here the sky is bright and immature. Here the sky is bright and intimate azure. Though we have to remember that in Rilke's usage of the words intimate or inward mean not only familiar and close, but powerful and compelling as well. That's really great, because I feel like Rilke, you know, everything is this huge energy, you know, that is in some ways spoken around and cannot be really spoken of. And Matthias and I talk about this too, because we're preparing to do a writing retreat, which still has spots available, and I'm going to do a little plug for it on a preceding podcast here. But if you want to sign up for our Poetics of Nothingness retreat, please go to ruthstonehouse.org. But right, so this idea of this sort of energy, which is a kind of nothingness, or that at least can't even be named directly beyond its own energiness, feels like it's very aligned with this intimate inwardness, even as it's sort of this completely external force, like God. And, right, so that's sort of, again, this paradox that is constantly coming up in Rilke, but also in just great poetry in general. So Rilke's usage of the words intimate or inward mean not only familiar and close, right? Because this poem's so much about the paradoxes of distance and closeness, something I'm very obsessed with in my own poetry too, and something, of course, that has come up in my psychodynamic therapy. Right? What is closeness? What is intimacy? What is knowing the other? What is the distance between I and you? Can one really ever know the other? Can one ever bridge that gap of distance? And I love this moment in the seventh elegy when he's talking about these fallen women, right? For each of you had an hour, or perhaps not even an hour, an analytic hour? For each of you had an hour, or perhaps not even an hour, a barely measurable time between two moments. The interstices. When you were granted a sense of being. So these little moments of sort of relationality and interstices where, and it's really, again, getting this idea of nothing. You sort of have these spaces in between, these spaces that are aligned with time and measure and form, or like boundaryless, boundary and containment. I know those sort of analytic terms, but they're also poetic terms, right? So we have this like form in which it's such a poetry thing, because we have this form where we have emphasis between leapings and a sort of energy between two unlike things, whether it's metaphor, whether it's simile, whether it's a line break, whether it's a stanza break, whether it's actually a leap in association, a leap in narrative, the leap between words. So a barely measurable time between two moments when you were granted a sense of being. So that negative space, that nothingness, grants us a sense of being. And I think, of course, of that moment of the impenetrability of the other's consciousness, the impenetrability of the object's existence, but in these glimpses of, you know, at a distance, but in an intimacy, we are truly being together at the same time. You were granted a sense of being, period. Everything, period. Your veins flowed with being. Right. I love how Rilke continuously will come back to the body. This really important, I think. But we can so easily forget what our laughing neighbor neither confirms nor envies. We want to display it, to make it visible. We want to make the invisible visible, right? Even though the most visible happiness can't reveal itself to us until we transform it within. Jesus, I mean, I could just sit with that for a million years. This is such a ontological text, right? I I love this. We want to display it. So we want, I feel like this speaks such to the poet's work too, right? We want so badly to articulate something inarticulatable in language. And that's why, you know, we love words with all our capacity to love words, but we also hate words with all our capacity to hate words, because they always fall short of that perfect articulation of being, which, you know, isn't they just, it's T.S. Eliot all over again from the Four Quartets, you know, raids on the inarticulate with our shabby equipment. And that's fine. That's all we can do. And that's what the poet does. They try anyway. And that's why I love this feeling of that force of the thing we can't name, we can't speak of, really, that's always in Rolke's poetry and gives it all this energy and life. Right, so we can't, in this line where Rilke is, even the most visible happiness, right, can't reveal itself to us until we transform it within. So again, coming back to this idea that Gardini highlights in his first sentence of his interpretation, which is that, like, the other is the real world of truth has to be built up from our inner experience. So transformation within as an alchemical event externally as well. But and this, you know, I think I've read this quote from Novalis before, but it was like, you know, this idea that, for, you know, we begin, you know, first the work is, like, I'm paraphrasing here obviously, but like, first the work is internal, and we do this, like, very intentional and internal journey, and then there's the external journey, but you have to have both, you know. But we always, you know, in some ways, I think, especially in our contemporary culture, in this idea of displaying visible happiness and this sort of toxic positivity and mindfulness culture that really bastardizes some sort of, like, denial of this dark inwardness, this darkness within that is part and of inner transformation in facing that complexity within us, things we don't want to look at. Nowhere, beloved, will world be but within us. Our life passes in transformation. I mean, you know, I think the other thing I'm thinking this is making me think of actually is that he keeps addressing the you and the she and the great one. You know, it's like there's definitely, like, movements to the talking to the angel, and that's obvious. But I think Rilke really shifts pronouns here and, like, who is speaking. And I love remembering that when we write a poem, how can we read the Rilke elegies without thinking Rilke's speaking them? You know, his voice is so strong. But at the same time, it's our voice. We're Rilke too, you know, and Rilke's us. And so when we have these cries, it's our cry, you know, it's us. The writer writes in service of putting voice into the reader's body itself, right? So we feel this granted sense of being, and our veins flowing with being, I think, comes with the cry of the poem itself, right? So it's a very important metaphysical event of poetry itself at its greatest, and the German poets are quite good at this. There really is a sort of dissolution of self that happens in poetry. I mean, I would say maybe a dissolution of ego, to interchange those words in a certain way, or, you know, or we could come back to this idea of, like, multiple parts of the self, which are, of course, overlapping with the universal consciousness that's so fucking real. You know, I'm like, I'm so obsessed with list, like thinking about the poem, The Nature of Things, on The Nature of Things, which I've got it right here, Lucretius. But you know, this poem of, you know, Epicurean philosophy, physics, you know, talking about the natural world, right? So essentially, you know, here's this poem, The Strong Voice of Nature, in Rilke's poem. And I think that's why, you know, I was quoting the Keats, the Romantics, because I think the Romantics were attempting a version of this speaking with and of nature, although they seem to be too much still of a separation of voices and man versus nature. But, you know, what Lucretius, the Roman philosopher and poet of the first century BC, in his book On the Nature of Things, his epic poem, is a sort of atomism. It's is, you know, the first you know, attempt at speaking about what atoms are, and that everything is made up of atoms, including us, including the soul, you know. So very threatening to the sort of religious world, but I can see a sort of Epicurean impulse in Rilke's work, and I wonder if you read this, actually, you probably did, where, you know, God and angels exist, but they're not concerned with listening to humans and won't respond, and we can't know anyway, so we might as well observe the world around us. And I think for the Epicureans, what I'm understanding is, like, a lot of it ended up being, well, you should enjoy the pleasures of life, and it's not about sexual pleasure, but it's the rich pleasure of observation of the nature of things. And so what I see poets like Rilke doing, and poets who really are looking and paying attention not only to the external world very closely, but the internal world, right? So this is what Rilke's thing is like, are we paying attention to the nature of the internal things? And the more that we pay attention to the nature of the internal things, I think the more we end up doing that second part that Novalis talked about, which is like, leaving the house, you know, so to speak, and paying attention to the external world. And the two are this oscillating sides of the same coin. And let's see. Wasn't all this a miracle? Be astonished, angel, for we are this. Right, so there's this miracle of the world, in the midst of not knowing whither. So, and this feeling of sort of like being the same thing as the stars, you know, being this, you know, this space that is ours. Like, we are the earth, and the earth is ours, and we might be made of the same thing as angels. He's positing, right? They might be, you know, in the Epicurean sense, they might be part of the atomism as well. If the soul is made up of is the same stuff of the body, we can't see it, but it's when the body dies, the soul dies, but then it all comes back because everything returns. Then why not the angels too? But the tower was great, wasn't it? Oh, angel, it was, even when placed beside you. Don't think I'm wooing angel, right? So I love this sort of, there's a kind of humor here at the end. Don't think I'm wooing angel, and even if I were, you would not come. For my call is always filled with departure. Now this, of course, is another theme that humans are so aware of of death, unlike the rest of the world, in our way. We're so haunted by our awareness of expiration, that we're always one foot out the door, Against such a powerful current, you cannot move. I love that line. Like an outstretched arm is my call. So that's still this like beautiful imploring acknowledgement of one's yearning there. And its hand held open and reaching up. You know, it's like that image of the hand held open feels like imploring, like to be given something, right? There's the call, the crying out in order to be comforted or appeased or given something. But no, then a line break to seize. So maybe there's even a little, sorry, I'm still on the tail end of therapy here. Leave me a little anger there in that seizing. Remains in front of you. So it's still just poised in front of this lowercase u, open as if in defense and warning. This arm and this hand is doing a lot. It's outstretched in a call and it's held open to receive, but it's also wishing like to seize, and it's remaining open to possibility. This is a lowercase open, unlike the beginning of the next poem, which has the O open. But he's also saying this hand is like a defense and a warning. God, I mean, to the angel? But then the last line is ungraspable one, which is capitalized far above. So a defense and warning towards God? I feel like it's capitalized. It does make it God and not the angel, but, you know, it's ambiguous. So ungraspable one far above. So far above. We here on the earth, so sonic, so grounded in this poem, are we? But then we have this sort of, I love this image of the bird and that the poet's cry could be like the bird. That's what the wooing should be like, this cry that just is in the world between earth and sky, in between the two, just, you know, of course, a parallel to the angel as well. And we do this through poetry. Right. So, you know, this beautifully idealistic vision of poetry that is gotten to in this poem and throughout this book, I think is such. Well, it's such a good pedagogy. It's such a good teaching to us how to write and how to read and how to be. God, thank you. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this episode of me riffing off of the Seventh Elegy. I read a little bit from Romano Guardini's Rocca's Duino Elegies and Interpretation. I talked about Lucretius, The Nature of Things, and I read from Stephen Mitchell's Duino Elegy Collection. Please stay tuned for the Eighth Elegy, which is coming in just a couple days. I have it all ready. I just need to edit it with the poet Matthias Slavina, who I will be doing an in-person retreat with at the Roof Stone House August 21st to 25th at the Roof Stone House in Vermont. So it's beautiful there. We're going to be talking about all these things. Exactly this topic, but we're also having daily workshop, 3-hour workshop every day of your poems on anything. And we're sort of be using these topics as a lens in which to critique and interpret and just doing a lot of discovery together. The evenings will be either enjoying guest speaker readers, or we'll be doing a salon style reading of our own work, new work that we're writing. We'll be having one movie night. We're going to watch Tarkovsky's Mirror. So good. And Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire. Oh, it's a Rilkean film if I've ever seen one. But please join us, roofstonehouse.org. It'll pop up on the homepage. But thank you all so much for listening, and until next time.